The Spirit of God, like a fire, is burning. Latter day glory begins to come forth. Visions and blessings of old are returning. And angels are coming to visit the earth.
Project Zion Podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts the restoration offers for today's world. As a podcast, we aim to feature a wide variety of guests and panelists with roots in the restoration tradition, including the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the Community of Christ. The bumper music has been provided by Mark Abernathy. You can find his music at mark-abernathy.com or saber-rattlers.bandcamp.com.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Project Zion Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Langston, and I'm really, really excited to be here. This is our inaugural episode. Just honored and delighted to have some wonderful guests on the podcast today. And kind of the purpose of today's podcast is to give a sense of the context that we're coming from. So we know that the Restoration, despite some of the narratives we might have heard growing up, didn't just kind of drop out of the sky, but instead it evolved within a specific time and a specific place to specific people, and probably for some specific reasons. So what we want to do today is kind of just take a 20,000-foot view of what the Restoration is and how it fits into both the context of Christianity generally, and then also what the landscape of the Restoration kind of looks like now. I think sometimes, again, we might get a sense, especially if we're coming from the LDS perspective, that, you know, that the LDS church is the Restoration, but in fact it's this kind of fascinating and diverse and wonderful movement. And we're going to explore that a little bit and then kind of talk about how that happens, how the evolution occurs, and how we construct our narratives around our sense of peoplehood, personhood, I guess, how we construct our narratives around faith community and faith identity and so on. So I'm delighted to have three wonderful, esteemed, and distinguished guests with me today. And I will start by having them introduce themselves. First of all, I'll ask Seth Bryant to share a little bit about himself. Seth, welcome to the podcast, and why don't you tell us a bit about yourself?
Sure. Thank you, Katie. So I'm Seth Bryant. I live in Heber, Utah. I recently moved here from California. I was working with the Navy as a Navy chaplain and was assigned to a Marine Infantry Battalion at 29 Palms. And technically, I'm still in, so I'm on terminal leave, but I'll be the incoming associate pastor in Salt Lake City, the Community of Christ in Salt Lake City. So I've done graduate studies in religion at the University of Florida and at Vanderbilt University, and I'm a convert to Community of Christ from the LDS Church.
Right. Thank you. Next, we have someone that's well known to the Mormon podcasting and intellectual circles, and that's John Hamer. John Hamer, welcome. Why don't you tell us a bit about yourself?
Hi. I'm really excited about being here. I'm excited about your new podcast. My name's John Hamer. I'm coming to you from Toronto, Canada, where I'm on the pastor team of the Toronto Congregation of Community of Christ, the downtown congregation. I'm also the church historian for Canada East, and I'm also, I guess I've done a lot of blogging in the Mormon Blogger and Ackle. So I was a blogger on DCC and Mormon Matters and Weeds and Terrors and done a lot of other blogs and podcasting. And I guess one of the things I'm known for is creating maps and diagrams of the restoration movement, including the broader Latter-day Saint movement.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I've seen those. Those are beautiful. Great. Thanks, John. And then finally, we have another seasoned guest, and that's Brian Whitney. Brian, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, Katie. So, yeah, I live in Utah. I'm a student at Weber State University. I'm studying history and sociology. I was an intern with the LDS Church History Department for about a year and a half. And past summer, I was in Nauvoo for the entire summer working with the Community of Christ at the Joseph Smith Historic Site, doing some research and tour guiding, which was also a fantastic experience. So I'm excited to be here. This sounds like a fantastic podcast.
Great. And Brian, you're LDS, right?
Yeah, I'm active LDS.
Okay, great. Very good. Well, thank you. Thank you all for being here. It's exciting to have you here. So I think we'll just dive right in, right off the bat. And first of all, we're going to kind of turn it over to Seth for a minute, and he's going to talk a little bit about how the Restoration fits into the Christian movement generally. So, Seth, why don't you share a little bit about how and when we see the Restoration evolve?
Well, Katie, I like that term that you used about it dropping out of the sky, because I think a lot of times believing faithful members of the Restoration seem to think that it just came out of nowhere. And I'm reminded of Revelation 21, where the New Jerusalem just drops out of the sky. But in fact, as you said, you know, it definitely has a certain context and a historical period. And I think that the project or what the Restoration was trying to do wasn't anything new, really, for centuries. We can see going all the way back to the very beginning of Christianity that there was contestation over what was the pure message, what was the correct interpretation. I think we can track that in the Bible itself. We certainly can track that in the very formative first few centuries of the church as doxy becomes orthodoxy or heterodoxy, and certain groups are defined as wrong or incorrect. As we move forward, I think the East-West split is again part of this desire to say this is what Christianity should look like. And then certainly, you know, the Protestant Reformation is huge in this. We look at Martin Luther. His intent originally was to put Christianity back on the correct course, to restore it. He did use that term, restore. I remember being very excited when I came across that in his writings, but that's what he saw himself as doing. It was never for the intent to divide the church, although ultimately that's what ended up happening. So, you know, we see the American context that influences the Restoration. It certainly brings some very interesting things to how they see themselves restoring this pristine church. You know, we look at the great awakenings that were going on, the revivals, and the experience of religion on the frontier. And there were some denominations that were very, very good at reaching out to people on the frontier, like the Methodists, like the Baptists, that could get to where people were at and share a message that really appealed to their common ethos. And to that American ethos, there was a rugged individualism that's involved. There's a desire to break free of what they saw as shackles of hierarchies, of past traditions, especially as they went back to Europe. And so a lot of these frontier revivals and religions that appeal to the frontier peoples, they really spoke to that individualism and that idea that the people had the power to come together and to discern what was right rationally. And so as Joseph Smith is in the midst of what he calls a contest, I think if I was a Presbyterian minister on the frontier or a Methodist, that excitement would be a good thing. He saw it as a very bad thing, but I think it would be a good thing because it's got people thinking about their salvation and coming to these revivals, looking for answers. But for Joseph Smith, you know, the very fact that Christianity was divided was obviously a sign that there was something wrong. And he fits within a much larger strain of Christian primitivism or restorationism that we see in the American frontier at that time. So most Mormons, most members of the Restoration are completely unaware of this, but there's an entirely other group out there that comes out of the same period, and they also call themselves the Restoration. And I'm talking about what we call today the Stone Campbell movement. And so the Stone Campbell movement, they are the restoration still in their terminology, and they have very little knowledge about us, most the average person. And yet these ideas were floating around in that time and place that if they could but restore the church back to its pristine New Testament state, that they could transcend all those denominational differences and become a coming sign or harbinger of Christ's kingdom, of the second coming. And so in the case of, it's really interesting when you look at the two restorations side by side of Stone and Campbell and of Smith, and some have argued Rigdon, putting Rigdon equal with Smith. But as you look at these two side by side, there's a real desire on Stone and Campbell's part, especially Campbell's, to create a very rational restoration. So they would go to the book of Acts, specifically, I mean, they really are interested in Acts chapter 2, but all of the book of Acts, and they would look at it like a blueprint and try to discern rationally what was going on in the early church, how do we get back to that pristine quality in the church in terms of its structure, its teachings, its practices, its values. And so it was a very, very rational attempt to get to the pristine church, the primitive church. And Smith, on the other hand, while there definitely is rationalism, there's very much a desire for the supernatural as well, for new revelation. So if Campbell would go to the Bible and read it like a blueprint, if he had a question, Smith would go to the Lord and ask for a revelation. And Campbell was just horrified, absolutely horrified about this. But Smith's idea was that the Bible itself obviously we were not capable to completely get back to the original church, including obviously the authority, the priesthood. And so there's this very supernatural element that becomes fused with the rational, individual affirming nature of Joseph Smith's restoration. And there was, you have one key figure that went back and forth between these two groups, and that's Sidney Rigdon. Rigdon was a bishop, was a leader in Campbell's movement, had many followers, and yet was very much dissatisfied with the lack of ecstatic outpourings of the Holy Spirit like you would see in the book of Acts. And so as Rigdon and Joseph Smith, as these two spheres come together, Rigdon already has, ready-made congregations, has followers, and Smith has that ecstatic outpouring of the Holy Spirit that Rigdon's looking for. And so Joseph Smith's restoration really spoke to him and didn't to Campbell. And there's some condemnation that went from Campbell upon Smith for this. But Joseph Smith, in restoring the church, was really engaged in a very, very old type of work that had been going on, for centuries. And what he brought to the table, though, that had not previously been brought to the table, was this idea of new revelation. And ultimately, he ended up expanding the footprint of the restoration, the footprint of the church beyond just that primitive church. His interest becomes in restoring the dispensations, previous dispensations, the Old Testament, which that was one of Campbell's biggest gripes. But Smith's ability to take some very American ideas, like the ability of people to come together and to rationally discern the will of God, of people to be empowered to claim God's blessings. But also, what Smith brought to the table was a surety that he was claiming that people could trust that the priesthood had been restored through him and not have to go through these aged institutions that were making similar claims. So it fit within the context of the times. It didn't come out of nowhere. It's surprising. It's amazing the different turns and twists that the restoration takes. And yet it very much speaks to that age and that time and to the anxiety that people had, and says, look, I've got an American answer. And whether they realized it or not, it very much was an American answer to the religious anxiety and the concerns of the day, and in a way sacralized much of American culture. We get, Zion here on the new what they would see as a, you know, the new world, Zion and Eden. The entire sacred story gets mapped here, which is, I guess, in some ways that was very surprising to other religionists of the day. They just didn't see that coming, and yet in the context and what Joseph Smith was doing and in taking, you know, the sacred story and making it accessible to these frontier peoples, he was inviting them to enter into the sacred narrative, to dare to re-enter into the sacred narrative in ways that spoke to them in their location, their time, and their culture. It really is an amazing story when we consider, we look at it, how different it is from the other groups that came to try to establish or to restore or to reform Christianity. Amazing how different it is, and yet certainly it fits within that context and that larger project.
Wow, thank you. That's a lot of insight there. John, anything when you heard Seth unpack that narrative? Is there anything that stood out to you that you wanted to comment on or add to?
Oh yeah, well, Seth, that was amazing. Thanks. I really, really enjoyed that. A lot of things just jumped out, but I completely agree with Seth that a lot of what we look at when we view Mormonism, we view the Restoration, our Restoration, the Latter-day Saint Restoration, as opposed to the Stone Campbell Restoration. A lot of these things look really distinct, and it seems like, oh, this is their own very alien, you know, a very alien movement or something like that. But there's so much of Mormon doctrine or early Restoration distinctives, especially the pre-Nauvoo. So this, the earliest stuff, the stuff from New York and Kirtland and early Missouri, that period especially is actually very common to other Second Great Awakening churches. There's a lot of those same ideas that are shared, and it's just that Mormonism has kind of preserved a lot of them in almost, you know, like preserving it in amber, whereas a lot of the Methodists may well have moved on and they aren't thinking about some of these doctrines the same way anymore. So I think that's exactly right, that it's coming out of this same context, and a lot of people are sharing these ideas, like the Stone Campbell movement. In Toronto here, actually, our congregation, we're across the street from a Disciples of Christ congregation. Our churches have been neighbors for the past 80 years, and we kind of consider ourselves to be sister congregations because we think they know us, we know them. They had a ordination ceremony that we participated in where one of their leaders was being ordained an elder, and they have elders and teachers and priests, I think. And so there's a lot of similarities between, you know, the Church of Christ that Alexander Campbell and other people in his movement restored and the Church of Christ that Joseph Smith restored. It's interesting. Go ahead.
And what are the churches that are extant, that currently exist, that trace a lineage back to Campbell?
Well, I mean, the broader movement is, you know, like, is called, the historic movement is called the Stone Campbell movement, and then it's the Churches of Christ, the Christian Church, the Disciples of Christ. So a lot of times we say Disciples of Christ to try to differentiate that from, I mean, the problem is that when the Restorationists got going, and this is true for the early Mormon Church too, like Seth was saying, they took the New Testament and in the Mormon case, the Book of Mormon as a scriptural blueprint. And it says pretty clearly in the scripture that the name of the church is the Church of God or the Church of Christ. And actually it says it even more clearly in the Book of Mormon about that. And so as a result of that, their goal, Alexander Campbell's goal also was sectarianism is bad, that we shouldn't be having, you know, Methodists and Lutherans and Presbyterians and Anglicans and Episcopalians, I mean, all the different denominations that Protestantism was fracturing into. And instead, their goal was, we just want the Church of Christ. We want to end sectarianism. And so, but the problem, of course, is that there's so many churches that are named Church of Christ, you know. And so as a result of that, right from the very start in the Latter-day Saint Restoration, before they came up with the word Latter-day Saint, people started calling them Mormonites or Mormons, which was a term that a lot of people in the Restoration have never really liked, although at a certain point the Utah Church embraced it for just because it is easier to I guess if you can't beat them, you join them. So all of those churches, it's hard to call them. A lot of times they call themselves just Church of Christ. A lot of times we say Disciples of Christ because it's easier to differentiate them from other churches.
Great. Fascinating. So I want to take a step back and maybe look at it from a little bit more distance and maybe from our perspective, in sort of a postmodern kind of place. But is it a fool's errand to think that you can recreate the early church?
Well, I think that rather than a first century reality, it's more a 19th century conception that they were working off of. There obviously were people who were followers of Christ, and they certainly had a sense of community and mission and identity. But to sit down and to say, well, it says here, and this is one thing, you'll find from the Campbell movement. We can't find an example of them using instruments in worship, so we're not going to do that within the church because that's what the church needs to look like. I think it's pretty clear that we just don't have enough information, and that to try to track one generation's concerns and language and everything that we carry with us, that baggage that we carry with us, and to say that there's a one-to-one relationship to what they were going through back then, and if we just create the right structure, everything's going to fall in place like it was back then. So part of that, I think, is a fool's errand. What I don't think is a fool's errand, however, is to try to create, to recreate that sense of purpose and community. I think that there was a very clear sense of love in the way that they looked out for the poor. One of the most basic verses coming out of the Doctrine and Covenants for Community of Christ or in the Book of Moses, that God called his people Zion because they were of one heart and one mind and dwelt in righteousness, and there were no poor among them. And that was present, and that is not a fool's errand.
Thank you. Brian, thoughts about that? Is it a fool's errand?
So I think that to try to recreate first century Christianity, you would probably have to assume that there was some sort of cohesiveness in first century Christianity. I think most religious scholars nowadays would agree that it was a pretty scattered and divisive time in Christianity within its first 100 years. You had the Marcionites out preaching. You've got Paul out preaching. You had a lot of contestation about the nature of Jesus and exactly who he was and his relationship with God and his ascension and resurrection. I think that for a 19th century perspective, there was an assumption that there was some sort of cohesiveness in early Christianity. But I also think that Joseph Smith seems like he at some point moved past trying to recreate early Christianity. And it seemed like he went further into trying to really kind of fulfill that Adamic kind of Eden-type restoration. And I think that some of this goes back to one of the things that we need to keep in mind with with this time period is that it's really only a generation removed from the founding fathers of our nation, and really only a couple generations removed from Puritanism and Congregationalism in the United States. And those ideas of America being this divinely sanctioned land and it being a new Adam or a new Eve was really present during that time period. And I think that this is something that really influenced the society and the worldview that Joseph Smith carried with him and grew up in. And so I think that it goes beyond, again, trying to recreate first century Christianity and really trying to create that new Jerusalem or that city of Enoch, as he often called it, really tying together both the Old Testament and New Testament.
Thank you. So you know, to kind of sum up what I've heard, there's this sense that when you go back and you look historically, what you see is that there really has been, there's really been contestations. Is that the word? There really have been contestations, and there have been disputes, and there have been these concerns all throughout history. And yet, when you're looking back at it from a 19th century perspective, you sort of have rose-colored glasses about it, maybe. And so the restoration movement comes out of this desire to be free of the contentions, the religious contentions of the day, and revert back to this sort of pure sense of what Christianity is supposed to look like. But really, all throughout history, human beings are being human beings.
Yeah, and don't we all kind of do that to a perspective, kind of look at the past and glamorize it, or say these, you know, those were the best days? We have a tendency to do that now, particularly among conservative traditions about the 1950s and 60s. So yeah, I think there is a certain amount of looking backwards and saying times were better, they were more unified, they were more pure, they were more simple, whatever the case is. And I think you definitely see that in the restoration movement.
Cool. So, John, so we have a movement here that's meant to restore original Christianity. At least that's what it starts out as, although as Seth and Brian and you have pointed out, it Joseph Smith seemed to take it far beyond that as he evolved in his role as a leader. Perhaps ironically, the restoration itself has not been free of splinters and schisms. And so tell us a little bit more about how, sort of what happened briefly to the restoration movement as it has kind of grown and flowered.
Sure. Yeah, well, I mean, part of the reason this happened is we were kind of almost figured out the ingredients for this, because on the one hand, like we've been emphasizing, the early restoration, the idea of it is restoring the ancient order of things. We're trying to get back to this pure Edenic way, things that are happening either in as it was known to Adam and Eve and the patriarchs, or as it was known among Jesus and the apostles and the primitive church. And so all of the different things that were restored were meant to be, that was the way things were supposed to have been. But then you also add to it, though, this other ingredient of individual revelation and especially prophetic revelation. So you're a church that is, on the one hand, restoring the ancient order of things through scriptural precedent, but on the other hand, you're a church that's having new revelation, new scripture, both the Book of Mormon and also the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible, and also the different revelations in the Doctrine and Covenants. And so as time is going on, there's additional things that are getting restored. And so what ends up happening for a lot of people is you restore some things a certain way, let's say in 1830, and then things have changed and new things are getting restored that maybe change what was restored in 1830 is no longer what was restored. And then again, you know, things roll on and a little bit further in 1838, things are changed again. And so for people who signed up earlier on, they may well have been committed to that first thing. I'll just say, like, as an example of change, the church is restored under the name Church of Christ. It then becomes Church of the Latter-day Saints, and it finally becomes Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints within Joseph Smith's lifetime. And so for people who believed that the only true church had to be called Church of Christ, when the church name changed to Church of the Latter-day Saints, they thought that was a sign of apostasy. So as things were continuously changing, and actually as the church was continuously moving from New York to Ohio, Missouri, and Nauvoo, different people, you know, who had signed on, different leaders, different early members, who had signed on to different conceptions of what the restoration should be, didn't always accommodate the change. And then also there were conflicts that could have happened over over things like failures of different enterprises that happened. Like specifically, a huge cause for schism was the when the church established a bank in Kirtland that ended up going bankrupt and everyone lost all this money. You know, that's the kind of thing that also is a cause for schism. So over the course of Joseph Smith's lifetime, the Restoration was evolving and changing. And in the course of doing that, it was throwing off people in the same way that it was bringing on new people. So different people who believed that they were holding on to the core principles of the Restoration would organize their own churches, which they'd often call the Church of Christ, to get back to the original name, would then leave communion with their fellow people and the fellow former co-religionists in the Restoration. And although they would then they'd be bitter with each other and they would have pretty mean recriminations to each other, they were usually operating, they were following what they felt was the actual faithful way. So they were trying to be true to what they believed. So.
And so what I'm hearing you say is that there are kind of little pockets of people breaking off all throughout the Latter-day Saint movement, all throughout the, as the church, like you said, moves from one location to another, people are kind of branching off here and there. And then there's a big schism, though, isn't there, after the death of Joseph?
Yeah, the biggest moment of schism then is when the succession crisis, so Joseph Smith is, and his brother Hiram are both martyred. At that point, there's no clear path who the successor would be. And so different people followed different directions, different successors emerged. The largest group ends up being led by Brigham Young and the Apostles. They move out to Utah. But there are several other groups that go in different directions. Lyman White leads a group down to Texas. William Smith, the sole surviving brother of Joseph Smith, has a group that's in Illinois. There's a prophet that emerges named James Strang, who leads people to Beaver Island in Lake Michigan, and there's several other contenders for the leadership. Ultimately, most of the other organizations, other than Brigham Young's organizations, splinter and fail on themselves, and so it leaves a bunch of people who are in opposition to Brigham Young's leadership without a church organization. They eventually reorganize and they believe among themselves that leadership will come from within the Smith family, and ultimately Joseph Smith's eldest son, Joseph Smith III, emerges and it says that he has had the spiritual calling where he feels called to be his father's successor, and he's ordained prophet and president of the reorganization, and that becomes the Community of Christ. So ultimately there's the largest church in the Restoration, obviously, is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, headquartered in Salt Lake, that everyone's familiar with. The second largest is the Community of Christ, which is kind of the Smith family church, the Midwestern Latter-day Saints. And then there's about 80 other Restoration denominations that have anywhere between just a congregation to a few thousand members. So.
Wow, that's amazing. Have you visited all of them? Have you visited any of the others?
Not all 80, but no, I have visited a lot. Yeah, there's just very interesting. The Strangites are wonderful. I've gone to church with them on a couple occasions and done a lot of research with them. The Bickertonites are really intensely interesting. Cutlerites, the Hedrickites. There's just the Fundamentalist Mormons out in Utah. There's all kinds of different organizations, and I know members from, you know, a couple dozen different churches. So.
Wow, that's cool. So, Brian, how does this happen? One of your specialties is narrative formation, and why? How do we get to where we are today, and how do we tell the story about ourselves such that even though we might say that we're clinging to this sense of purity and this unity, yet there still is division, and yet there still is schism, and how does that happen, and how do we reconcile it?
It's an interesting paradox, isn't it, that everybody is trying to cling to a restoration, and in the process they end up creating another schism. They're trying to unify, but it creates disunity as a result. It's really a fascinating thing. But I think that kind of going back to what we first talked about, I think applies here as well within either whether it's early Christianity, whether it's Protestant Reformation era Christianity, or whether it's early American religious pluralism or Mormon schisms. I think that you have this idea of things have changed and we need to go back to the golden age of when things were the best. And certainly you see that with within the early Mormon denominations. I would say that John and Seth, you can agree or disagree with me. It seems like the majority of Midwestern Latter-day Saints that were still hanging out and still faithful members, but didn't follow Brigham Young and his group west. It seems to them, in their worldview, Ohio probably would have been the best time of the church's life. Would you both agree with that?
Well, I think in some cases, even by Ohio, maybe it's problematic.
Maybe John, maybe you can help me out on this.
Well, I wasn't a David
Whitmer. Pre-Kirtland banking scandal.
Well, I think even by 1830, David Whitmer was upset, right? That it was more 1829 sure. that he would have looked at things as being pristine.
Sure.
Yeah, but David Whitmer's representing a fairly small group, you know. So I mean, I think what he's saying is that the bulk of them are settling in on a early Kirtland kind of era experience when people are remembering this incredible outpouring of the Spirit after they dedicate Kirtland Temple, but before the bank, you know, goes bust.
Exactly.
You know? So there's like
exactly
this moment, you know, it's so wonderful. We all sing Spirit of God together, but we haven't like, you know, all gone bankrupt together, you know.
Well, you know, eventually that same place we all sang together, we're going to have a knife fight, you know, inside of the temple. I mean, it becomes a very contentious period.
I didn't know about that. That's juicy.
Exactly. I think that what you're looking at here was there was this epiphany experience there, right? This Pentecostal epiphany experience. And wasn't that the great experience that everybody was yearning after? Wasn't that the Anglican minister, help me out, Seth, George
Whitehead. You thinking it John Wesley? Oh, Whitehead.
No, not
Wesley.
Whitehead. Yeah. Wasn't that kind of his romantic vision, was this epiphany experience, this personal transcendent experience. And these saints in Ohio felt that they experienced that. And of course, the narrative of that would be carried forward. So even though you've got a lot of converts after that period, they're being told of this experience and this outpouring of the Spirit that John described. And so this is really kind of where they're hanging their hat, so to speak, and where they're going to create their identity and where they're going to reaffirm their identity. And so for them, it makes sense to reject some of the later innovations, if they even knew about them, that were taking place in Nauvoo. And I say if they even knew about them, because a lot of what became mainstream in Utah was really practiced by a very small and discreet chosen group in Nauvoo. It wasn't the widespread mainstream practice, and there were still plenty of Latter-day Saints that weren't even living in Nauvoo at that time. There were saints that were still back in Pennsylvania, as we know that Sidney Rigdon was out there leading a stake. A lot of people tend to forget that the church still at this point had the Kirtland Temple, well, still does technically, but had the Kirtland Temple fully operational during the Nauvoo period. So there's still these groups and pockets and congregations of Latter-day Saints all around who weren't part of that later 1842 to 44 Nauvoo experience. Did you have something to add?
There's the people. Well, the people there are actually the bulk of the people are the, you know, not everybody can gather to Nauvoo, right? So it's really committed people gathered to Nauvoo, but the bulk of the church membership, in terms of people who have actually been baptized, you know, elders are running around everywhere and they're baptizing people, like, you know, really fast, and you just get ordained into priesthood almost immediately upon being baptized. And so they organize branches everywhere. And so the bulk of the baptized members are out in branches in the Midwest and the Northeast and in England. And so it's not that they may not even be active. They may not be doing anything. But anyway, some of them are. And like you say, none of them are hearing about any of that kind of stuff. All they know is what they can read in the Times and Seasons, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And if go ahead.
I was just going to say, if we've got a group of people to whom primitivism appeals, you know, they hear this story of Kirtland Temple, and it's basically Acts chapter 2 lived out large on the American frontier. I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing to see. It's not just primitivism. It's like actually, you know, accomplished. And so at the same time, you know, it's more than just Acts chapter 2. Obviously, Joseph introduced high priests, and so there's other dispensations that he's bringing into that. But, I agree with you, that it definitely, for those that didn't coalesce and head to Utah, that Kirtland period is certainly the ideal and the romantic point on which, you know, restoration history hinges.
We can even hear that narrative directly when we just listen to William Marks' story. So William Marks, who had been the state president in Nauvoo, is a great friend of Emma, you know, and then he goes on after he doesn't side with Brigham Young. He goes with Sidney Rigdon. He becomes a Rigdonite. He later becomes a Strangite. He becomes a Thompsonite. And ultimately, he becomes a member of the first presidency in the reorganization. And when he comes back to the reorganization, he tells his story. He says, I finally have found that old-time Latter-day Saintism. I finally have seen that old thing that I've been looking for. So they had that nostalgia. They wanted to go back to that Kirtland, and that was the thing that they found when they reorganized.
So there's a couple of things that I'd like to hit on. One thing that Seth said and one thing that John just said. Now, Seth, we've brought up Acts 2 a couple of times here, and I think that another key component of Acts 2 was this concept of communal society and communal living. And this coincides, again, with the Ohio period, where the law of consecration and stewardship was a revelation that Joseph Smith felt that he had received. And this would have not been unusual for this time frame. In fact, actually, Sidney Rigdon came out of that communal tradition as well. He was part of what was called the family, which the Campbell tradition had some dealings with. You may know more about that aspect of it than I do. But this idea of creating this, that was, from what I understand, that was one thing that really set apart Sidney Rigdon as a preacher, was this idea that there had to be some sort of communal type living society in order to recreate the Christian experience. Now, Joseph Smith's revelation was quite a bit different in how communalism was structured, but nonetheless, this was another Ohio period thing which really tried to create this idea of social cohesiveness and bonding and caring for the poor and kind of overall group acceptance. Now, this is something that it didn't work, and it rarely does with any group, but it wasn't replicated in Nauvoo, at least not very successfully. But what's really interesting to me is that out of the groups that emerged out after the succession crisis, nearly every one of the major ones attempted to recreate some sort of communal type living society at some point in their history. James Strang tried creating it in the early 1850s. Sidney Rigdon tried creating it almost right away when he went back to Pennsylvania. Lyman White created a communal common stock society down in Texas, which actually probably succeeded more than some of the other ones up until the Pedernales River flooded, and they lost their land geographically. But and then if we all know that Brigham Young, well, us Latter-day Saints know that Brigham Young tried recreating it in the 1870s in Utah with the United Order systems. But once again, here's this thing that creates a group identity, right, is this idea that we're all sharing together and we're all co-owners of industry and homes and of our meals together and all of these social interactions that take place in trying to create a communal system. I think that there's a lot of folks that came out of the Ohio / Missouri period because they really kind of ran concurrently to each other, but there was a lot of people that emerged out of that that really desired to go back to that communal type living. And I think that that was part of a loss of identity in Nauvoo for some of those folks. We can see that up in Wisconsin at the pineries that the Saints commissioned out. The leaders up there, George Miller and Lyman White at that time, tried to create a communal society up there. Lasted for about a year.
Wow,
now John,
fascinating.
You'd mentioned, I'm losing my train of thought now, but you'd mentioned William Marx saying that he had found the old Latter-day Saint tradition. And what's really interesting to me is that really his identity of the old Latter-day Saint tradition is arguably kind of a new Latter-day Saint tradition. In that it's
well, you
really
know, I mean, that's the thing with right from the Restoration, right at the beginning, which is, you know, when you were asking, is it a boondoggle or what? I can't remember what you said. Is it a pipe dream or whatever to go back?
Fool's errand. The fool's errand.
Fool's errand. Yeah. So you can never go home again, right? You can't actually restore the Relief Society that exists in Heber, Utah today isn't exactly the same as the Relief Society in Nazareth at the time of Christ, right? In other words, it's different.
I mean,
you can't go home again.
That was when Mary Magdalene was the Relief Society president, right?
I know. You see, it was way more political back then.
Yeah.
Anyway, in that exact same way. So William Marx too, he can't go home again. He's in a different era already. He's a different experience. He's, you know, in other words, it is very different when he's trying to go back, but he's sensing it that way. That's what he's feeling. You know, that's what he wants.
Yeah.
You know,
so. And he's very sincere about that. And I think that really what emerges out of this, and Joseph Smith III really, I think, you know, he and William Marx are pretty eye to eye on this, is trying to create this moderate form of Mormonism. And if you look at it, it makes sense. Just based on the geography alone, it makes sense. Brigham Young and his masses are out in the middle of nowhere, on the other side of the Rocky Mountains, and they're able to create a social identity pretty much from scratch out there. They don't have a lot of neighbors that are going to come and tell them that what they're doing is breaking the social normatives of society. But out here in the Midwest, they're still surrounded by American culture, still surrounded by American society, politics, government, militia units, other denominations and churches. And so they kind of had to get along. Certainly they didn't want to recreate the experience that they had all witnessed in Nauvoo. And certainly Joseph Smith III didn't want to fall into the same fate of his father. And you can't blame him for that at all. This desire to recreate this quote unquote primitive Mormonism, if that makes sense. Is really a desire to create a more moderate and socially acceptable form of Mormonism. Something that wouldn't cause them to get into such strife with, and a good example of that, I think, is when Joseph Smith III is asked whether or not he's going to try to do the gathering again, right? Try to start the gathering. And what was his response to that? No. No, I'm not going to do that.
Right, yeah. His response was, that whenever our people gathered, that's what the problem was. In other words, when we gathered in all these numbers, that's when we were immediately perceived as a threat by all of our neighbors. That's when what we were doing, you know, immediately, you know, stepped on what they perceived as their rights, you know. So suddenly if we start overpopulating the county, and the county is becoming a Mormon county, and everybody in the Mormon majority are all block voting for Mormon stuff, and everybody else is being pressured out, then suddenly all of your own property, you know, isn't worth anything because you have to sell it cheap to get out of there, you know. So anyway, so all of those pressures were very real, and they did cause, you know, it caused antagonism to neighbors. But, you know, if you look at it from the neighbor's perspective, you know, with actual cause. And so, I think in for Joseph Smith III, a guy who is growing up, you know, his dad has been killed, he's been driven you know, from all the places he grew up as a kid, and then from his later teenage years on to adulthood, he's living in the ruins of his father's city, Nauvoo. You know, he's got to be thinking about it. This thing went off the rails a little bit, or there was some mistakes were made, and so that's where he's coming from, where he's thinking to himself, well, this is really when we went wrong, and we should maybe do something different to try, you know, learn from our mistakes.
Yeah, and you'd mentioned that Joseph Smith joined the reorganized movement. I think that's something that a lot of Latter-day Saint listeners don't know. A lot of folks that I know from the Utah tradition tend to think that Joseph Smith III started it, or even one step further, that Emma started it. And I think it's important to understand that they didn't start it. They joined it after 6 years of it coming together. 1852 to 1854 is really when it starts coalescing. Jason Briggs, Zenas Gurley, a couple of the followers of James Strang. By 1860 is when they join it up in Amboy, Illinois at the conference and are received in. But I think during that period of time when Zenas Gurley and Jason Briggs are talking to Joseph Smith III and saying that they felt that he had received the blessing from his father to become the president of the church, you got to imagine, and I'm fictionalizing this a little bit, you got to imagine that part of the reluctance of Joseph Smith III had to be, well, I saw what happened to my dad, and I'm another Joseph Smith leading another Mormon church. Like, this never works out well. I've seen this.
Yeah.
And again, I'm editorializing a little bit here.
Sure.
But
what he actually did say, though, in other words, why he was reluctant, yeah, was, I'm not going to come forward, and you may want, you folks, not only you people in the reorganization, but the people out in Utah, a lot of people come by and tell me that they wish I would come and join their church and be apostle in the church or be a leader of the church or whatever. But I'm not going to come forward with a spiritual calling like that unless I actually feel called of God. You know, that's how he fits it, which I think expresses integrity. I agree with you that you may well also be sitting around saying, well, my dad got killed over this, maybe I don't want to do that. But I think that he really was waiting for an actual spiritual calling, and when he received that, that's when he felt he should come forward. So.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with you, and thanks for putting that in there, because I think it is very important to make sure that we frame this from his perspective, which would have been receiving a spiritual witness to do this, which I do believe that he received. What's going on here, though, is you think about his childhood of growing up in Nauvoo, and this goes into narrative construction, Katie. I'm not venturing away from the question too far.
Yeah, sure.
So what kind of an experience and environment did Joseph Smith III end up spending the rest of his teenage and early adult years in Nauvoo? Certainly in his early childhood, he saw a lot of tumult and craziness. Number one, a lot of people in Nauvoo compared to what it was like after the majority of Mormons scattered from Nauvoo. So the population went from 13,000 people down to, you know, maybe 1,000 or two. And number two, you get these new groups moving in, taking over some of the old Mormon homes, such as the French Icarians, moving in a couple of hundred utopian-minded people. They weren't necessarily a religious group, but they were trying to create the perfect system of society. And then you've got the German Catholics moving in at the same time. And really, Nauvoo, for all intents and purposes, really becomes a German Catholic town from this point forward. Emma somewhat returns to her roots of Methodism. I'm not saying that she converts to Methodism, but she at least finds some sort of community with the Methodists. The children are being exposed to different strains of religious thought. They're not being raised strictly in a restoration mind frame, if that makes sense. And so for them, they're going to have, and I think that this influences Joseph Smith's later leading of the reorganized church, they're going to have a little bit more of a tolerance for pluralism. Perhaps that pluralism that was rejected within earlier strains of Mormonism.
He but what you're framing is exactly right, which is, you know, Brigham Young is off in really in isolation, and people are able to develop, you know, just, you know, within their own framework. But that is not the case for the people that are in the Midwest who, like you say, are living in the context of the people, the rest of the American society, the Icarians, the everybody else who lives in Nauvoo, everyone else who's in the Midwest, you know. So the as a result of that, you know, the reorganization is actually happening in the backdrop of the U.S. Civil War, which is it's not like it's not a real thing for the people out in Utah. The people out in Utah are seeing it as the time Armageddon's at hand, the world is about to end and everything like that. But it isn't that they're immediately participating. And the people who are in Nauvoo are right next to Missouri, you know, which is didn't secede, but it's a slave state. And so the Civil War is all around them. And so that's one of the things that's influencing the early reorganization to become a peace church in reaction to the Civil War. So like you say, there's all these contexts that's very, that affects both strains.
Mm-hmm. One thing I think that Joseph Smith III had access to was an intimate understanding of his father. And I think that may have come through Emma to a large extent. But, he was obviously, through his childhood, he saw and heard stories and knew that his father had that he grew in his understanding and how he sought to implement Zion over time. And so as Joseph Smith III is considering, you know, how do we approach this? And I don't know if he ever sat down and said, how do we create a moderate Mormonism? But as he's thinking of how do I look at this, I don't think he saw himself at all as breaking with his father, but really saw himself as called in that moment and that time to take something everlasting and to make it new in that moment, to borrow, you know, from, I believe, section 20, the new and everlasting gospel, that his own father's journey, adapting, growing, evolving journey over time, gave him freedom and also some leeway in many instances to rethink and reimagine based on the conditions and the circumstances he found himself in, and certainly all of his Nauvoo experience as a lawyer, as a sheriff, or a justice of the peace, is all of those experiences he had living in Nauvoo and in doing things other than leading a church gave him depth and perspectives that were unique and helped him to shape the reorganization in ways that reflected his father's vision to some extent, but also carried its trajectory forward in different ways from what obviously was going on in Utah, as you pointed out, Brian, with that geographical isolation. They just didn't have that pressure, and that freedom gave them the ability to continue some of the more esoteric practices of the Restoration.
One of my favorite stories when I would take people through tours in Nauvoo was in the Red Brick Store on the bottom level, the main floor of the Red Brick Store. There's an original desk from Newell K. Whitney that was given to Joseph Smith III. Newell K. Whitney couldn't fit the desk. It's a writing desk. Couldn't fit it on his cart, that was much later, but on his ox cart. And so he bequeathed it as a gift to the Smith family and gave it to Joseph Smith III. Now, here's how I liked to tell this story, because I think it really symbolizes the difference between kind of his mindset and what was going on out at Utah. So just prior to receiving this desk from Newell K. Whitney as a gift, Brigham Young apparently gave him another gift, which was a hair-triggered pistol. Now, I think that in itself speaks volumes and is very symbolic. And apparently Joseph Smith III almost blew his head off with this hair-triggered pistol. There's a lot of stories that we have of Joseph Smith III as a youth coming pretty close to accidental death, and this was one of them. So he, and I don't know if this was through his mother's encouragement, but he ends up getting rid of this hair-triggered pistol. The desk that Newell K. Whitney gives him, and he gives him a writing utensil, a writing pen, and he says to Joseph Smith III, according to legend, he says, I want you to always remember that the pen is mightier than the sword. And Joseph Smith III, in his memoirs, talks about how much of an impact that had on him and how he remembered that. And so when we talk about identity formation, this is one of those singular moments where it's kind of a formative moment for Joseph Smith III. This decision, even subconsciously or later on, at least looking back at this incident and assigning this meaning to it, of saying, I decided I was going to be peaceful rather than raising a militia. And I don't know, I love that story, and I loved sharing it with people. They usually got a good laugh, a good chuckle, but I think it had a real good point.
I was just going to say one thing I love about that story too. Didn't he receive a Bowie knife from Brigham Young as well, which ended up in Emma's kitchen? So,
yeah.
But I think the really interesting thing in this is that both in the pistol and the Bowie knife on one hand, and the desk and the pen being mightier than the sword on the other hand, both of those potentials exist within Joseph Smith Jr.'s teachings and his experience. You know, we've got Zion's camp going to redeem Zion on one hand, and then we have suing for peace later. And all of that potential exists, and in some ways, all of these diverse manifestations of the Restoration, almost cafeteria style, pick and choose what version or what strain they want to live out of that earlier Restoration experience, what speaks to them. And certainly the suing for peace became I can't even speak to how foundational it is to Community of Christ. It is just ingrained within everything that we do, and it's certainly that story of the Bishop Newell K. Whitney's desk is the perfect example of these ideas bouncing around in the young prophet of the reorganization's mind as he begins to shape and to honor God's call to bring about Zion in this next generation of saints.
I think that's a perfect segue kind of to the last question that I have and the piece that I would ask each of you to touch on a little bit. And that is, you know, we've kind of stirred things up a little bit here. We've looked at the history, and we've said that the founders of the Restoration, Joseph Smith and others, were operating under, you know, we've problematized those, and we've looked at how the quest for the pure faith ends up leading to more schisms and sort of an ironic twist of fate. And we've looked a little bit at this idea of narrative and identity formation, and it kind of leads me to this question. I think this is kind of what this podcast project is all about. And that question is, so then what? And what's the point? So if we look back and we say that the narratives that our ancestors or those who have gone before us were living in, if we can look at them and see that they were just narratives, and we can even apply that to our own sense of belonging, where we are now, and look and recognize we're just operating within a narrative as well. It kind of leads to that question, then what? Then what is the value of our faith? What is the value of us claiming the Restoration as part of our identity? And this is, I think, a personal question. It's something that I would like each of you to maybe try to touch on and share a little bit about what it is for you and why it matters to you. We'll start with Seth.
So I guess the best way to answer this would be to talk about an experience I had standing on the temple lot, the original temple lot, and looking at all of the diverse manifestations of the Restoration. And at first I was a little dismayed by this, and I thought that how sad it was. This is the place the saints were supposed to be the most united. And from that spot to go out in unity to all the world, and then to look and to see all of these divisions, I mean, literally, you can see at least four different factions. And if you draw the circle wider, there's group and churches, all these different groups of the Restoration. And it made me think of Joseph's experience there in that camp meeting. And I thought that was incredibly ironic, as has been lifted up, that all of these diverse voices making different claims, and it's almost like we just replicated it all over again. And then I was struck by the fact that were it not for that diversity in those camp meetings, that Joseph never would have went into the Grove. I think that that maybe in some ways that original desire to get back to the original church, that perhaps it was misguided in some ways. But look at what it's given us. And rather than, you know, say that the that there was some purity in the original church and we've lost it, or there was some purity in the early Kirtland era and we've lost it, I like to look at our experience with God as an ongoing, developing journey. And God speaks to all of us differently. And rather than look at, you know, this all of these diverse voices as a bad thing, I think it's a wonderful thing that God is speaking to us, even if we understand it differently. The only downside is when we use those things to divide us rather than unite us together. We build walls. And so I think the restoration was a worthy project. And I think and I know that it continues to bring meaning to countless individuals, including my own life. It brings meaning. And so the only caution that I would lift up is, you know, rather than looking at all of these diverse manifestations as a bad thing, isn't it wonderful that God continues to speak and that so many people are responding in so many different ways to bring about Zion and the kingdom of God on earth?
Thank you. Brian.
Seth, that was beautiful.
Thank you.
So I'm going to push back, Katie, on just one thing that you said.
Sure.
You said just narratives, and I think that we need to be careful not to minimize the importance of narratives and narrative in society for a group or for an individual, because I mean that's almost like saying, well, it's just your soul in a way, right? I mean, this is the intrinsic quality that binds us together, that creates some sort of idea of society and of meaning. We create these narratives, or we buy into these narratives that other people created, but for us they become very real, right? And there's a sincerity behind it. It's not like, oh, I know that this is just a story, but I like it. No, it is. This is my reality. We talk about worldview a lot, but really, that's what it's a paradigmatic perspective, right? What's your paradigm? What's your narrative that you hold to? And this is something that we recreate every time that we tell the story. Every time that we bear our witness to somebody, we're reconstructing that narrative. And this gets into how memory works and all this really cool psychological stuff. But I'm going to talk about this more sociologically and how it creates some sort of sense of social identity and social cohesion, and how that shifts over time. And the paradox of it is that while it's shifting, nobody knows it's shifting. And so we have this tendency 200 years later to say that, at least as far as the LDS Church, and I think that the Community of Christ is maybe a little bit, has emerged to a point where they're a little bit better at understanding that history has changed. But at least within a lot of the LDS construct, it's the church is today the way it's always been since the beginnings of the Restoration, right, since 1830. Almost as if everything just kind of landed in Joseph's lap and he got all the revelations at once, and everything has been laid out in a clear path since then. And
dropped out of the sky.
Yeah, dropped out of the sky, exactly how we open this up. And what we see when we look at it historically is that there's been this constant rejuvenation and recreation and recreation and re-identification and reassignment of things for all of the traditions, which emerged out of Mormonism. So, you know, we've talked a lot about Brigham Young in the West and the Midwestern Latter-day Saints who coalesce and create this identity around the reorganization movement, which in Nauvoo, I would jokingly say that most people don't know that the original name of the church was the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, comma, we are not the polygamous Mormons in Utah. that was on the business cards.
They still say it.
But there, what you have is an identity being created as to what they are not, right?
Yeah.
Which is part of the reason why in 2001 the public name of the church was changed to the Community of Christ. I think that over time you get tired of constantly explaining who you're not whenever you introduce your church to somebody. But during that early period, you've got a really important deviation between the two groups, and that's the practice of polygamy. And one group in the Midwest saying, no, that's not us, and the other group out in Utah openly practicing it and saying, this is our constitutional right to practice our religion how we want to, at the odds of the rest of American society, and certainly at the cost of not achieving statehood as early as they wanted to. Well, as Utah gets closer and closer to statehood, their narrative has to shift. They have to get away from this idea that plural marriage was a necessary component of eternal exaltation and salvation, and start kind of changing that to something that's a little bit more socially acceptable, something that will at least allow them to be able to ultimately phase it out so that they can join in with the rest of American society. Now, think about what that does to the Midwestern reorganized saints who, throughout their past 40 years since the origins of the movement, have identified themselves as the non-polygamous Mormons. Well, after about 1904, 1905, when polygamy phases itself out slowly of the LDS Utah Church, that's no longer a distinguishing factor between the two. It gets less and less and less. Now, like you said, John, there are still some who hold on to that as the distinguishing factor. But by and large, Mormonism in Utah starts joining the American mainstream. At least, let's say, after like the Reed-Smoot hearings in 1906, which were highly publicized and really created a lot of national attention for those 3 years. And what emerges out of that is a new kind of Utah Mormonism, a much more moderate form of Utah Mormonism, ironically, based on how the reorganized church had positioned themselves as the moderate form of Mormonism. So from there, you have to create a new identity in order to create this idea of a unique system of theology in a unique society. Now, it's tough for me to speak on the reorganized movements and the various identity shifts that it's been through. Certainly, we see it in the 1980s as women were admitted into the priesthood, and certainly we see it again in the early 2000s with the name change, and we're seeing it again now with the acceptance of LGBT and kind of the dynamics that's going on within the various congregations over these issues. Within the LDS Church, I would argue that there were some major identity shifts, one that I already mentioned around the Reed-Smoot hearings and America accepting Mormons as another denomination that wasn't as odd as the early Utah Church was. And then you've got another paradigmatic shift in post-World War II with the rise of Christian fundamentalism and Christian conservatism, and the LDS Utah Church really grabs onto that and really becomes part of the kind of Christian right movement. And that's something that still influences the LDS Church to this day, this post-World War II, Cold War era Christian literalism, fundamentalism. The reorganized movement seemed to kind of recreate an identity in the opposite direction, at least by the mid-1970s, start moving into the opposite direction and siding more with the liberal faith traditions, not necessarily demanding a literalistic perspective on scripture, for instance, and, you know, certainly not siding with as much conservative politics, at least not cohesively as a whole group. Maybe certain congregations based on their geography tended towards it. But as far as like the hierarchy of the church or the global leadership of the church, they weren't necessarily espousing as much anti-ERA rhetoric and things of that nature. So it's interesting how you've got these on both sides of the equation here. They're almost unintentionally reacting to each other, and it's almost been that way since the beginning. And I say unintentionally because I don't believe that the Quorum of 12 in Salt Lake and the reorganized leaders are sitting in their independent temples, the Temple in Independence and the Temple in Utah, saying, well, how can we make sure that we're different than those guys still? Right? I don't think that's happening, but it's almost by virtue of the original reasons why they were separate from each other and why they never really, you know, came together as one cohesive movement. These ideas that they see things differently, that they frame things differently, and that they interpret what it means to be a Latter-day Saint, a Restorationist, or a Mormon differently than each other. It's fascinating to me. One of the things that I really found fascinating in Nauvoo, and I think that the Community of Christ folks that I worked with found it just as fascinating of a question to pose back to me, was how do you interpret Mormonism with or without the Nauvoo innovations of like the secret temple ordinances and things like that. It was very interesting for me to experience how the Community of Christ interprets their identity as a restorationist people without the temple ordinances and temple rituals. And I think that it was also very interesting for them to find out from me how that is such a central part of the Latter-day Saint experience.
Thank you. John, what would you say? What is the point, you know?
Well, to what Brian was saying, I think that he's exactly right, that especially all the way up to the mid-20th century, maybe not as much since then, that the two churches are reacting against each other like way more than especially LDS people know. I think our LDS people did have an awareness, since they were so much smaller always than the LDS church, that and people have come in the Community of Christ, we definitely have come up with this idea that, wait a second, way too much of our identity up through the middle of the 20th century was a negative identity. We're not the Mormons, kind of, meaning specifically we're not the LDS Mormons out in Utah. But on the other hand, the amount of reaction that the LDS church had against what the RLDS church was doing, even all through the 19th century, was pivotal to all of Mormon history, even to the idea that I think I would even argue that possibly that even John Taylor's succession, as opposed to one of Brigham Young's sons succeeding in the presidency, and then just the method of succession where the senior most apostle always succeeds as president of the church, may well be a reaction to the RLDS missionaries in Utah. So in other words, there's major effects that affect all of Mormon history too, based on what the RLDS church was doing. So I totally agree with what Brian's point. On the question for myself, what are we making of the restoration? What's the value still now in the 21st century? I think that one of the really powerful things that was happening with the Restoration in the 1830s is, here you had this moment in Second Great Awakening in America, where there's this idea that Protestants, Anglo-American Protestants, had that the sole source of authority is the Scripture. And they want to not have sectarianism, but the problem is they have no other way of disputing doctrinal questions than, you know, reading it in the Bible. And every single time anybody reads Scripture, you're interpreting it. I mean, we don't even read it in the original. We're reading a translation. The translation is interpretation. Our own reading is an interpretation into our own language, our own thoughts, into our own experience. It's always an interpretation. And so you can't agree, because you read one passage and you say, this means this, and someone else reads another passage and they think it means that. And so there was no way of settling those kind of disputes, and so sectarianism is the inevitable result. But one of the other things that was happening is, because we're so alien in the modern time period now from these ancient scriptures that are thousands of years old, there's the sense that what we're reading there is totally different, that they're living in this heroic age. They're living in the saintly age where God is connected to them in some kind of completely different way than God is connected to us. And so there is this sense in the Enlightenment that the heavens are closed. And the Restoration is arguing, no, the heavens are open, and we have the capacity. The early people in the Restoration truly believed, when they're sitting around in Kirtland Temple, when they're having this Pentecostal season, when they're living out Acts, when they are writing not only new scripture, receiving new revelation, when they're writing their own histories, they're writing it in that same scriptural speak. When they write, when John Whitmer, who's the historian of the church called by Revelation, when he's writing the history of the church, he's writing it in that same, you know, and it came to pass kind of Book of Mormon verbiage and everything like that. They believe, really, they feel that they're actually living scripture. They've come back. They've connected it. Now, whether or not we, that you can actually go home again, we said that you can't. But you can realize that in your lives, we aren't any different from people in the past in terms of our ability to connect with God, to our ability to connect with the divine. It's not that the heavens aren't closed between AD 36 and AD 1830, and they're not closed since Joseph Smith's death. So we shouldn't all put, any more than we should put the primitive Christian church on a pedestal and say, boy, that was a different era, none of that kind of thing. Nothing happens like that now, or the same thing, the early saints, the early restoration, nothing like that happens now. Rather, we can be living scripture right now. Revelation continues. We have the same connection with the divine that everyone has always had throughout all the time. And that's what I think is just completely powerful about the restoration idea. That's completely relevant to us today.
Thank you so much. Wow, this has been a wonderful conversation. And lots of good insights and history and context. I thank you all so much for being on the program today, and appreciate all of our listeners. Maybe there are three or four of you by now. So thank you for being there, and thank you for taking this journey with us. We hope to, throughout the course of this program, do some exploration of the Restoration, kind of like we've done here, understanding the context and then also understanding how that could apply, how that could possibly apply to us right now in our lives. So very much appreciate all of you for being with us today, and thank you much. We'll talk soon.